Okay, we will we'll start part four here, the fourth and final hour of ethics. Once again, this is Richard Clem. We're coming to you on June 18th, 2014 today, and this is part of our four-part ethics program where we work our way through the rules of professional conduct. If you need more information about this program, if you don't know what you're listening to or how to get credit for it, you can visit my website, richardclem.com, and you'll find out some more information about it. And during the program, I will be giving a couple of code numbers. It'd be a letter E for ethics, followed by a three-digit number. At the end of the program, send me those code numbers. There are a total of eight of them. Two of them will be given during this hour of the program. We're on Rule 6.1, Rule 6.1 talks about our pro bono obligation. And as many of us know, we're supposed to engage in pro bono activities. Specifically, what our obligation is that we shall aspire to provide 50 hours a year of pro bono. What's our 50 hours of pro bono? That's 50 hours of assisting persons of limited means with their legal problems. So there are other things that we should be doing, other public service activities, protecting civil rights and protecting the environment and whatever we want to do in a public service context, and we're supposed to do those things as well. But our 50 hours specifically is to be spent assisting persons with limited means, limited economic means, with their legal needs. Like I say, your obligation is you shall aspire to do the 50 hours. So if you wake up on January 1st and say, yes, this year my New Year's resolution is to do my 50 hours of pro bono, you have satisfied your obligation. If you wake up on January 2nd though and say, no, I've changed my mind, I'm not going to do it, then you're in violation. But there's no requirement that you actually do it, but you shall aspire to do it. In addition, you're supposed to engage in law reform activities. You're supposed to improve the legal system, and you shall not seek to avoid appointments by a court unless you have good reason, like it would result in a rule violation, or it's just beyond your capabilities. But in general, you're supposed to do those things. Those pro bono activities carry with them some potential conflict of interest issues. So the remainder of Rule 6, 6.3, 6.4, and so forth, talk about some of the special conflict of interest rules that cover these situations. 6.3, for example, says what your obligations are if you're on the board of directors of a legal service organization. So one of your obligations up there said you're supposed to volunteer and help out those organizations. So you get appointed as the board of directors of Pro Bono Legal Services, Inc., a nonprofit organization that assists people of limited means. Well, that's a good thing to be doing. But potentially, those people are going to be suing your private clients. So what do you do in that conflict of interest situation? Because you can't be on the board of directors of one law firm while your other law firm is representing the opposing party. That's like being the attorney for both the plaintiff and the defendant. So normally that would be a serious conflict of interest. But in that context of you being on the board of that legal services organization, that's permissible. However, you have to recuse yourself from cases where you have a personal interest or your clients have a personal interest. So you can keep representing them even though their clients are suing your clients, but you have to recuse yourself from those decisions. Similarly, you might you took seriously the call of Rule 6.1 and you are engaged in law reform activities. You're a volunteer with the Bar Association committee that's rewriting the probate code or whatever. So that's something you're supposed to be doing. But perhaps your private clients benefit from the law in its current unreformed state. Well, if that's the case, normally that would be kind of a serious conflict of interest. But here you can continue those law reform activities, but you have to disclose the fact that you're, when you make a decision, that you have private clients who are benefiting from that. And Rule 6.5 covers the situation of you volunteering at the law clinic of the Bar Association or a law school or something. So they have a law clinic where they go out to the mall and set up a table, and people can come in and discuss legal problems with an attorney for free. And you're one of those volunteers. What if there's a conflict of interest there? So what potentially happens there is during the day you represent an insurance company. Your private client is an insurance company. Well, these people come in to your limited legal services day at the mall, and they start, they don't name any names, but they start telling about the horrible things that their insurance company has been doing to them. And this insurance company has just been egregious and doing terrible things to their client or to them. By the time they're finished, you have tears in your eyes from the horrible things that this insurance company has been doing to these people. So you tearfully tell them you need to sue these people, because that's just terrible, these egregious things that they're doing. Well, unbeknownst to you, that you just advised them to sue your client. Because it was your client who was doing these egregious things. And normally that would be kind of a serious conflict of interest, but in this context, where you were not aware of it, the rules are watered down a little bit. So that's not a violation. Obviously, if you knew about the conflict of interest, if they identified the insurance company involved and you knew it was your client, well, then you should have obviously not talked to them. But in that limited situation where you're just not aware, that would be okay. Well, Rule 7.1, 2, and 3 talk about advertising. And until a couple of years ago, the advertising portion of the program went on for about 2 hours because I did the Iowa version of the advertising rules. The Iowa version of the advertising rules were very complicated and very very old. Iowa still clung to the old advertising rules that greatly limited what you were allowed to advertise. Well, that's changed a lot because about 2 years ago, Iowa amended its rules. Now, I should let any of you here live know, if you have the materials in front of you that say Ethics 2013, some of you have got old copies. There's a section in there about registering your trade name with the Iowa Supreme Court. It turns out those rules are wrong. They did not get adopted. The 2014 version, I removed that erroneous information. But if there's a copy of my materials floating around that talk about registering your firm's domain name with the Iowa Supreme Court, you don't have to worry about that. But instead, Iowa's advertising rules are pretty much in line with the other 49 states now. I think the Iowa Supreme Court kind of saw the handwriting on the wall that if one of their advertising cases went to the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court would probably disallow those rules because they were very restrictive. My favorite one was that radio advertising, you were required to have a single non-dramatic voice. You're not allowed to have, I don't know what a dramatic voice is or a non-dramatic voice is, but for Iowa radio advertising, it had to be a single non-dramatic voice. So it had a lot of arcane little rules like that. But that's now kind of history, now this part of the program goes a lot faster. Because now in Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, yes, you can advertise. Rule 7.1 says that you can't make any false or misleading communications for advertising or any other purpose. So you have to be truthful in all of your public statements. Rule 7.2, first of all, says that you can't pay anything of value for anybody to refer your services. So Rule 7.2 is the real reason why you can't have referral fees. And like I say, if you do have a referral fee, don't call it a referral fee, because referral fees are against the law. Under Rule 7.2. So you can have fee sharing, not a referral fee. Advertising, though, is kind of like a referral fee. So the rule makes clear that, yes, even though you're not allowed to have a referral fee, you can pay somebody, namely the radio station or the newspaper, to say good things about you in an advertisement. So yes, you can pay the reasonable cost of otherwise permitted advertisements. Really, the only substantive regulation governing advertising is this paragraph that says any advertisement must include the name of at least one lawyer or law firm who is responsible for its content. So if you put up a billboard at the dangerous intersection that says, call 1-800-INJURY, that's fine, you can do that, except you do have to have on there your name, either your name or your firm name. Rule 7.3, so that's advertising, that's it. We've talked about advertising now. Yes, you can advertise. And there are a few more restrictions we'll get to in a minute. But Rule 7.3 talks about something that, ironically, even though Iowa had these very restrictive rules, this one is one you're allowed to do. What you are allowed to do in writing, not by telephone contact or in person, but in writing, what you can do is you go down to the jail on Monday morning and get the names of everybody who's arrested and send all those people a letter saying, I understand you need a lawyer, and that's permitted advertising. If you do that, you have to make sure that you comply with the rules scrupulously. The outside of the envelope has to have a certain language on it. I think it's the words advertising material. Interestingly, that has always been permitted in Iowa, even though there were other restrictions on advertising. The exact rule changed. So if you had some old envelopes printed for that kind of advertising, you have to throw them away and get the new envelopes, because the wording on the ad changed. But you are allowed to do that in writing, but not in person. Communicating fields of practice. Incidentally, in Wisconsin, and formerly in Iowa, they used to require this in Iowa, they did away with it, but in Wisconsin and some other states, but not Minnesota, when you do send out those letters, you are required to send a copy to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Make sure that you look up those exact regulations and you'll find out where to send them. But if you send those out, you have to send a copy to the state. That's never been a requirement in Minnesota and is no longer a requirement in Iowa to do that. But some other states have a similar requirement. Communications of field of practice. This is one area where whatever you have to say about advertising, I think it's a good idea that the Iowa rules were kind of liberalized here. Because basically Rule 7.4 says that yes, you are allowed to say what you do for a living. Yes, you can truthfully communicate whether or not you practice in a particular field of law. You can communicate that you're a patent attorney or an admiralty attorney. If you do personal injury, you say, yes, I do personal injury cases and bankruptcy and whatever. You can advertise that. You can tell people what you do for a living, which is kind of a basic thing, it seems to me. You have to be careful if you use words similar to certified or specialist or anything kind of close to that. Because if you say that you're a certified specialist, or similar words. I'm a certified real property specialist by the Minnesota Bar Association. You can say that, but number one, it has to be true. And number two, there are some limitations on who can do the certifying. In Minnesota, for example, the organization certifying you has to be approved by the Minnesota Board of Legal Certification. So you can say, I'm a certified real property specialist, certified by the Minnesota State Bar Association, provided the Minnesota State Bar Association has the seal of approval of the Minnesota Board of Legal Certification. If they don't, so for example, I'm a certified real property specialist by the Arkansas Bar Association. Well, the Arkansas Bar Association, they're not certified by the Minnesota Board of Legal Certification. So if I say that in my Minnesota advertisements, I would have to put a footnote saying that that's not recognized by the Minnesota Board of Legal Certification. In Iowa, you have to be truthful. It has to be a real organization that grants that certification. And I believe you have to say that the Iowa Supreme Court does not have any special requirements. So yes, if you are certified by the American Trial Lawyers Association as a trial specialist, there has to be some meat to that. So in other words, I can't operate a diploma mill as a side business. So for example, you know, I could say, for $100, I will send you out a certificate from the Richard P. Clem Board of Legal Certification, which attests to the fact that you are a certified whatever you want me to put on the certificate. Well, in Minnesota, you could say that you are certified by the Clem Board of Legal Certification, but you would have to put a footnote, basically saying that that organization is bogus. In Iowa, you would not even be allowed to get away with that, because you have to demonstrate that it's a real organization that does the certifying. So I'm not going to go into that business. Firm names and letterheads. Do lawyers still have letterhead? I haven't had letterhead for at least 10 years because I just use my word processor to print it out. But if you have letterhead, there's few restrictions on how you list your name, but mostly this rule talks about your firm name. And in Minnesota and Wisconsin and now Iowa, you can practice law under a trade name. Until recently in Iowa, you were not allowed to do that. So so you had to use your real name if you were in Iowa. If your name was Smith, you could be the Smith Law Firm or Smith and Jones, attorneys at law. But you were not allowed to call yourself, Hawkeye State Bankruptcy Law. Well, now you are allowed to do that. You can call yourself Gopher State Injury Attorneys or Badger State Criminal Law or Hawkeye State Bankruptcy. You can use a trade name like that. It's now permitted in all of those states. You have to be careful. It can't be false or misleading, obviously. But the main thing you have to watch out for in selecting a firm name is that you can't imply a connection with a government agency or a charitable organization. Two words to watch out for there. First of all, one Supreme Court has taken the opinion that the use of the word clinic implies connection with a nonprofit, because clinics are apparently nonprofit. So naming your law firm the Legal Injury Clinic or whatever, well, that might be problematic, at least in the opinion of that court. The other thing to watch out for is geographic names. So here we are in Ramsey County, Minnesota today doing this program, and I decided to create a new law firm, and it will serve people here in Ramsey County. So I call the name of my firm Ramsey County Attorneys. Well, that would be problematic because there's a government agency by that name. And almost any political agency, political subdivision that you select, you're going to run into that problem. So, if I call myself St. Paul Attorneys, well, that's not quite as bad, but that kind of sounds like maybe I'm connected with the St. Paul City Attorney's Office. So it's best just to avoid names of communities. Instead I could call my firm the Como Park Law Office, because Como Park is not a geographic, or it's a geographic area, but it's not a political subdivision. One thing I mentioned, I'll backtrack on specialist. Watch out anytime you use the word specialist, because then those certified specialist rules kick in. One attorney got himself into a little bit of trouble, and it was, I don't think this would have happened in Minnesota. I think this was New York, where the their bar association was a little bit more conservative. He had on his, I don't know, it was like on his LinkedIn profile or something, but he had something on the internet describing his activities, and he said that I specialize in hard cases, or something like that. Well, the New York Bar Association took like that and said, wait a minute, you said you're a specialist in difficult cases. Can I see your certification by an accredited organization? You know, the National Association of Difficult Cases. Well, he didn't have it, because that's not what he meant. But they seized upon that word specialist. So watch out if you, I'd probably avoid the word specialist after hearing that poor guy's story. Like I say, if you have a copy of my materials that says that you have to register your trade name with the Iowa Supreme Court, you can ignore that, because that was proposed and it was dropped at the last minute, so that you don't have to worry about that, or you don't have to register your website name. Now, moving on to Rule 7.6. In Minnesota, you don't have to worry about this rule, but I wouldn't do the following anyway, because this sounds a lot like bribery, and it'll probably result in you going to jail. So don't do this, even though there's no rule against it in Minnesota. But definitely don't do it in Iowa or Wisconsin, because it violates Iowa Rule 7.6. Political contributions to obtain government legal engagements. A lawyer shall not accept a government legal engagement or appointment if you make a political contribution or solicit contributions for the purpose of being considered. So I send a political contribution to a candidate for governor and say, hey, governor, my purpose in making this contribution is so that you will consider me for this lucrative judicial appointment. And then he's elected, and he lets me know that he's, and I accept that position. Well, I violated this rule. But like I say, as the former governor of Illinois could probably tell you, even though this rule is not in effect in Minnesota, you probably shouldn't do it anyway, because you're probably going to wind up in jail. And I don't know why they didn't adopt it in Minnesota, but they didn't. Well, in our remaining 25 minutes or so, we'll get through the kind of miscellaneous rules here. Bars, admission, and disciplinary matters. Rule 8 just kind of covers the procedural stuff and some miscellaneous rules. And Rule 8.1 says that, first of all, you become subject to these rules the moment you send in your bar application. So if you're in law school studying for the MPRE and you mail in your bar application, you're subject to the rules we've been talking about as soon as you drop that in the mail. You have a duty to, in connection with your bar application admission or somebody else's application or a disciplinary matter, either yours or somebody else's, to be truthful to the board that regulates attorneys and admits attorneys in the state. You even have a duty to come forward if you think they have a misapprehension, and you are required to respond to lawful demands for information from those agencies. You shall not knowingly or recklessly make a false statement about a judge or candidate for judicial office or a legal officer. And if you are a candidate for judicial office, so in Minnesota, if you go down and file to run for judge, you're also, at the time you file, become a candidate, you are subject to the rules of judicial conduct in addition to these rules. Now, this rule, it's kind of interesting because Iowa has this identical rule. It says you shall not knowingly or recklessly make a false statement about a judge or a candidate for judicial office. Now, there's not really any such thing as a candidate for judicial office in Iowa, because you don't have contested judicial elections there. So I don't know what that is, what that means in Iowa, other than perhaps your name is in contention for appointment as a judge. But in Minnesota, obviously, that would apply to a candidate running for office. One Iowa attorney kind of pointed out to me kind of an unintended consequence of this rule that came up in 2010 during the first round of recalls of the judges of the Iowa Supreme Court, because in about 2008 they ruled in favor of gay marriage in Iowa, and a number of members of the public that was unpopular, and they wound up getting themselves voted out of office in 2010. Well, most of the state bar was behind them, but some attorneys, for whatever reason, they took the position that, well, no, I think these judges should be removed from office. And that's what that's the position that they held. That was certainly a minority position. But the attorneys taking that position kind of felt the brunt of this rule because they always had to be careful what they said in connection with any public statements, because they always ran the risk when they were saying, well, yes, vote no, vote against our incumbent judges. In making that statement, you always run the risk of knowingly or recklessly making a false statement about that sitting judge. So they were always kind of at risk of violating this. Whereas the majority of the lawyers in the state who said, no, we support our judges, vote yes, well, they're also making public statements about the race, but they don't run any risk. Because they're not going to say anything negative about anybody. They're not saying anything negative about a candidate for public office. It's kind of interesting that this provision was at least viewed that way, as having unequal application. Now we don't have that issue here in Minnesota, because we still, so far, and I don't think they got it on our ballot for November. But so far, we have contested judicial elections. So if you, at least we have kind of an equal playing field under this rule, because if I'm one of the people who's saying vote judge so-and-so out of office, yes, I run the risk of saying something negative and violating this rule, but that judge's supporters run that same risk, because they could say something about that candidate. So kind of an interesting unintended consequence of how this interacts with the judicial election process. Let's see, reporting professional misconduct. Rule 8.3 says that you are required to turn in your friends who violate the rules. If you become aware of a violation of the rules by another lawyer, you have an obligation to turn them in, either violation by another lawyer or by a judge. Unless you learned that information because it was confidential as part of a attorney-client relationship. Rule 8.4 kind of lists miscellaneous. It's kind of a laundry list of all the things that you can get disbarred for. First of all, violating the other rules. If you violate the rules, yes, you can get disbarred or suspended or reprimanded. Even if it's not in the rules, if it's a criminal act that reflects adversely on your honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer, that is also a violation, and you're subject to discipline. For example, I saw a case a few weeks ago of a repeat DWI offender. This attorney who had multiple DWIs, well, he got faced discipline for that, because that probably affects his fitness as a lawyer. If you're going to be out getting multiple DWIs, you're probably maybe neglecting your client matters as well. Or, on the other hand, anything involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, it's a violation. Or stating or implying an ability to influence a government agency or official contrary to law. Or assisting a judge in conduct that violates the rules of professional conduct. Discrimination and harassment are dealt with a little bit differently in all of the states. In the elimination of bias program that you might have, if you were here live today, we quoted the exact rule in Minnesota, but most other states have a similar rule, that if you engage in harassment or discrimination, that's usually a violation of the rules of professional conduct, or just any conduct that's prejudicial to the administration of justice. As you can see here in the materials, a couple of states most states have one or two additions to this list, usually resulting in from somebody who maybe committed this particular violation. They realized they didn't have any rule against it. So Minnesota, you're subject to discipline for refusing to honor a final and binding arbitration award after agreeing to arbitrate. So that must have happened, and they added a rule. And Nebraska, for example, has a rule that you can be disciplined for not paying child support. So like I say, different states add in other miscellaneous provisions. Rule 8.5 says, is kind of a grant of jurisdiction. What state Supreme Court has jurisdiction over you? Well, if you're admitted in a state, so if you're admitted in Minnesota, or if you're admitted in Wisconsin, or you're admitted in Iowa, obviously that state has jurisdiction of you, no matter where the conduct occurs. But even if you're not admitted in a state, if you are practicing law in that state or offering to provide legal services, then you are subject to discipline in that state. So if I go to Wisconsin to conduct that deposition, I'm offering to provide legal services in the state. So by going over there for that deposition, the Wisconsin Supreme Court could conceivably discipline me. And the rule makes clear that I'm subject to discipline in more than one state. Well, finally, choice of law. Usually you don't have to worry too much about choice of law because the rules are usually identical in most of the states. So as you see, we've covered for the most part, the rules are identical everywhere, so you don't have to worry about those things too much. But sometimes it might come up. So the first rule is that if you are in court before a tribunal, the rules of that state apply. So if I'm in a Minnesota courtroom and I commit a violation of the rules, the question is whether I violated the Minnesota rule. And the Wisconsin rule doesn't apply to me. For other conduct, if I'm admitted only in one state, well, that's me, I'm admitted only in Minnesota, then that state's rules shall apply. So that, most cases, that I just have to worry about the Minnesota rule, because that's where I'm admitted. But if you're admitted in more than one state, then the general rule is that the rules of the state where you principally practice would apply. So if your office is in Minnesota, but you're also admitted in Wisconsin, generally you would apply the Minnesota version of the rule if there's any conflict. However, if it has a predominant effect in another jurisdiction, then that state's rule will apply. One kind of practical application of that rule that came up was, as I drummed into you, you're not allowed to have referral fees in Minnesota. But some states do have referral fees, such as California and Michigan. Michigan allows referral fees. Well, I had a Michigan / Wisconsin attorney take my program. She had her office in Michigan, but she was also admitted to practice law in Wisconsin. So her concern was, well, will I potentially get in trouble with the Wisconsin Supreme Court if I take a referral fee from this Michigan case? And by looking at that rule, I think we decided that she didn't have to worry about it because the rules of the state where she principally practices apply, and that was Michigan. You know, if it had been a Wisconsin client or a Wisconsin case or something, then you might argue that it had its predominant effect in Wisconsin and you would apply the Wisconsin rule. But otherwise, the Michigan rule would apply, and in Michigan, that is okay. Before I wrap up this portion of the program, because we are at the end, I will give you that last code number, which is E-423. E as in ethics, 423 is the final code word for our four-part program. So thank you once again for joining me. Again, those of you taking the podcast, You can email all of those code numbers that you heard during the program to clem.law@usa.net send them to me by mail, P.O. Box 14957, Minneapolis, Minnesota 55414, and I'll get you out a certificate of attendance. So thank you very much for attending, and I look forward to seeing you all at future programs.